Welcome to The Squid of Despair, unscripted musings on business life, leadership, creativity, transformation, and all the myriad of other work-life events that get in the way of a good night's sleep. Hosted by David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor.
Hello, Daz.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm good. And you know what? I've got some great news.
Good.
There is no squid in the room. I think we've addressed everything head on, dealt with it like mature professionals that we are, and everything's okay now.
But does that mean there's not a squid of the day?
No. Well, there is a squid of the day. Oh, of course, there's a squid of the day, but there are no squid in the rooms. Remember, there's a difference here. There's a just clarification we've done in the past about other squids. But I, you know, before we do kick into what is squid of the day, and I give you the opportunity to ask that magical question, I do have a recommendation.
Okay.
Now, I happen to know that you're about to go on vacation to Paxos. I won't say exactly where, because we don't want the hordes of listeners to try and track you down.
Paxos is a very small island, and I think you've just given the game away. But okay, where are you heading with this?
Actually, the recommendation I've received is that Mambo in Gaius Paxos has allegedly the best squid on the island, if you happen to want some squid while you're there.
Well, well, thank you for that. I will have some squid while I'm there, and I will take a photograph, and I'm sure you'll post it on our website at some point.
Absolutely. Although, like,
our two viewers don't want to see me in a swimsuit, so perhaps I'll be careful what I send to you.
Well, if they land at either end of the island and they kind of do a pincer movement, they will eventually find you. Anyway, go on, say the words.
Come on, Peter. So what's the squid of the day?
The squid of the day, Daz, is team. I want to talk about teams. And whilst you grapple with that in your brain about what you want to talk about when it comes to teams, I looked up, you know, again, my research is always very in-depth. It's interesting. So one definition is Professor Lee Thompson of the Kellogg School of Management. I'm not sure what cereal's got to do with any of this, but apparently Professor Lee Thompson said that a team is a group of people who are interdependent with respect to information, resources, knowledge, and skills, and who seek to combine their efforts to achieve a common goal, which is quite good. There's a more up-to-date one, which I think is very exciting as well, because it says a team is a group of individuals, human or non-human, working together to achieve their goal. I think it's kind of moving with the AI times and the robotics and the rest of it there. So there we go. Now, I want to kick off, you know, I'm going to ask you to explain yourself, actually.
I don't like the sound of that.
Well, teams are really interesting. And my team, and we have a motto, which is, we've taken the T-E-A-N-M, and we joke that we our motto is that together, everyone achieves more. You see what we did there with the T-E-A-N-M. There is another one, which is together, everyone annoys me. So it depends how you feel about a team you're in. You can go either way. But I reflect, and I'm, you know, I am continually grateful for the fact that you've employed me on many occasions. But I have been, party to watching you put together some of the most eclectic teams in business, some real mixtures of characters, and somehow you do bond us into a team. And I'd love you to talk about your thought process behind that, or is it just pure luck?
Well, I'm speechless, actually, because this is the secret sauce, isn't it? This is the magic. This is the difference.
Oh, I see. You don't want to give trade secrets away.
No, of course not. I'm being silly. yeah, I mean, quoting sort of the thing that came to my mind when you said teams is the office, and that, that sort of the mawkish, there is no I in team. Do you remember that? Brent sort of number. Well, can I ask you a question back while I sort of think about how I answer your question? What causes you to bring this to the table, Peter, as a squidism?
Well, I've been thinking and talking a lot about teams recently. I mean, part of my job has been to absorb two teams, to merge them into one team. We've seen some expected attrition in that area, and therefore it's bringing in new people. To kind of create the team I feel that the business needs to deliver the expected successes through initiatives. So a lot of work is done on team. And it just kind of struck me that I don't know. I don't tend to go about it in a particularly scientific way. I mean, I have done that in the past. I've used predictive indexing and stuff like that to construct a team, and it all worked very well. But actually, so much is just on gut feel. Do you think that person you can work with? Do you think that person's going to work with whoever they were going to report to? Do they work as a team together? It's a huge leap of faith often.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a leap of faith. And, there are lots of aphorisms and out there with respect to teams. We know some of them. The one I like is, no one of us is as smart as all of us. And I think the sort of this the wisdom of crowds, there's something about the collective understanding of a problem is bigger than an individual understanding of a problem. And I think when you have diversity in teams, and we've talked about that this a little bit before, you get unexpected perspectives on a problem that allows for unexpected outcomes. There's a guy, I can't forget his name now, who I saw speak many, many years ago. And he had this great metaphor for how the world evolves, and how if you're stuck in your way of thinking, you get stuck behind. And I think teams help you not get stuck in yesterday's thinking. So the metaphor goes something like this: imagine you're in a race. So it's a sort of an allegory for business, and you start off in a swimming pool, and you dive in, and you start to swim along the pool, and then the pool gets drained of its water, and several people are still trying to swim along the pool, and someone actually recognizes what's going on and gets up and starts to walk, and then they start to run, and the people who are still swimming get left behind because the person who's running has spotted that the environment's changed and he's moving much quicker. Then the pool fills up again, and the swimmers gain superiority. And then one of the swimmers recognizes if they put flippers on, they can go faster. And then they put a snorkel on, and they overtake the swimmer. They overtake the walker who's now drowned. And so, the story is a clumsy one about how the environment changes, and actually, it's about responding to those changes in the environment that gives you the competitive advantage or allows you to achieve more than the other components of the group who are working towards the same goal. And for me, the magic of teams is teams who are diverse give you that range of ideas that you can allow the business to flex according to the environmental changes. It's how you see it's you see organizations stagnate sometimes when people recruit people in their own image, don't they? There's a challenge when people feel comfortable with people that are like them, and so they recruit people like them. And for a while, you get a team that's sort of very uni-faced. They tackle problems in the same way, they tackle solutions in the same way, but then the business changes, and they're not equipped to deal with that sort of variety. And so, the current focus we've got on DE&I, recognizing the fact that we all have profound differences in the way we view the world, and embracing that from a recruitment perspective, and embracing that from an inclusiveness perspective in the way we employ people, I think is a fantastic thing for teams. It brings us a huge problem though, because we talked last week, didn't we, about the use of humor in group dynamics.
Yeah, we did.
And one of the problems with humor is that it can be divisive because not everyone gets it, and it can be cruel, and it can focus on difference like humor, sexuality, religion, geographical differences. And that's true with teams. And so for me, you were kind enough to say I've created some great teams in my lifetime with at work, and I do. That's the thing that's given me the most pleasure, I think, in my working life, that sort of dynamic of creating teams that work together. The magic, the trick, and the thing which is, I think, the art is getting teams to gel. So, maybe we could spend some time there.
Yeah,
If
that'd be
we
good.
recognize the truth of the power of diversity, if we acknowledge the fact that a diverse team will come up with a range of creative solutions to a changing landscape, How do you get a group of very diverse, intelligent, strong-minded people to actually coalesce around the decision-making process? Because I think that's probably the problem or the challenge with diverse teams.
So yeah, okay. So let's just, there's a lot in what you kind of said. So I'm going to pick up on a few things I wrote notes down quickly. I mean, I think one is it kind of struck me that I think this is part of the problem, and I don't want to get into politics, but you know, this is probably off part of the problem with governments after a period of time, that they, you know, the leader is often surrounded by little people, you know, leaders or sub leaders who are like them, and then suddenly that dynamicism and the challenge disappears and they become, you know, inadequate for the actual job itself. So that's you know, one thought. I think the other one is, you know, when I think about team success, there's a couple of things. I mean, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have a couple of people who have joined me in more than one company. You know, I kind of emulate how I've slavishly followed you around the world. And had a great time about it in doing it. But it's quite rewarding that someone decides they want to work for you a second time, and in one case, a third time. It says you're doing something right. And I think the other thing is, it's just always wonderful when you watch a team resolving things, or you know, self-managing in dealing with problems the way you don't have to get too involved in. It's like, you know, oh, look, hang on, they're taking leadership themselves here, and they're addressing a problem, and they're coming up with ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the sort of the end game with teams, where you get this perpetual sort of improvement ethos. I mean, it's interesting what you said about having people sort of following people. You know, of course, in our case, Peter, it's five times now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's more to do with
the best. You are the best. Yeah.
No. It's more to do with the fact that no one understands you, and you know, I translate, but
and I can't go and find anybody like me to employ. You know.
Yeah. No. That is so true. I mean, if we think about the sort of components that allow high performing teams to perpetuate that sort of model you just described, I think there's a few things that are in place. If I think back to the teams I've built and I've enjoyed some success with, there's some underpinning sort of tenets, I would say. Let me see if I could list them.
Okay.
You know, we talked about the power of diversity, and that's to do with having different frames of reference. But then within that dynamic, there's got to be a respect for opposing views, which is a complicated situation because it requires people to stand up and be heard if they disagree, but it also allows for at some point a collective decision to be made. And so I think there's two parts to that. One is culture. I think there's something important here about culture, which is about everyone feeling they've got a responsibility to contribute, that there's an understanding that not everyone will believe the same thing, and that's okay, but actually to do it in a respectful way, to use language that's heard. So there's a lot there around the importance of culture in diverse teams to allow them to work together. And I think it's at heart, it's about respect in all its flavors. So I think you need a healthy culture for a high performing team to survive. Okay. I then actually think you need a process, because how many times have we, you know, run brainstorming meetings where we've got the creative juices going and it just gets horribly out of control, and you know, you're awash with ideas, which is fantastic. You know, ideas are cheap. I think you need as many of them as you can in order to give yourself the possibility, but ultimately you've got to pick one. And yeah. So there needs to be
a squid of despair almost.
There we go. Brings us back to our origins, doesn't it? You need a process by which teams can coalesce around ideas and come up with a resolution in a way that, you know, in political terms is called cabinet responsibility. You may actually not all agree with respect to the developing the argument, but you all agree when you leave that room, or you leave that virtual space, that you're all going to say the same thing afterwards, because that's how you move forward in a collective environment. And I think the last, well, perhaps that, yeah, then two more things related to that. I think you need a strategy as a team, don't you? You need to have, you know, what Sir Edin calls its North Star, but other companies, you know, call it the, you know, the, it's a strategic intention. It's a catechism. It's a very clear statement of what you believe as within your group is true and what you're trying to achieve, which is framed in a way which brings me sort of back to one of our earlier squits about the importance of a good question about what is our purpose. So I think once you've got your purpose, you've got your diverse team, you've got your culture, you've got a process, I think then you've got an environment in which people can prosper, albeit that they're very different. And then I think you've got to have a really, really strong communication technique and mechanism, which is what you do so well, to make sure that everyone understands what it was we've just agreed and what the consequences are of that.
Oh, beautifully, beautifully put. And I love the way that we're kind of connecting with other things and other podcasts. It's almost like, you know, we know what we're talking about.
It almost feels as though there's a book in there. How many books are you on at the moment, Peter? Sorry, I haven't asked you that for a couple of sessions.
It's embarrassing. So number 30 will be published in October.
And number 30, that's that the AI one?
That one's been published for quite a while. You obviously haven't read it yet. Now, this one's around team analytics. Hence, okay. My particular interest in the topic and so forth. So,
well, tell me about team analytics and how that relates to what we're talking about here in terms of developing high performing teams.
We're not doing this just to plug my books, you know. But
aren't we? I'm sorry.
I appreciate the opportunity. Yes, I've written a book with a gentleman called Betsy Goldman, who's founded a company called Perflow, and it's all in there. What I love about it, it's you know, it's technology into the world of AI and looking at data and looking at, you know, measuring how people who are part of a team, whether that team is a, you know, a shift or a group or a department or a project, you know, it doesn't matter, but it's how those people are feeling about each other. You know, we all do surveys and we give feedback on how much we love Ceridian, for example, on a, you know, twice a year basis. But this is about, in the moment, how you feel about your team members and what could be improved and what's being challenged. And it's done through a technology called micro nudges. And it's, you know, it offers up some real insight and some guidance. And so it's like a super aid to the manager and the members of the team as well. The knowledge is shared in all directions, but it's really like understanding how everybody feels at this point in time. And sometimes that's really hard to judge. I mean, you can be in a meeting with people for, you know, 2-3 hours sometimes, and you don't necessarily always know how they feel. They're really, really grumpy or deliriously happy, I suppose.
It's interesting. So do you think that AI, in the way you've just expressed it, actually is sort of addressing something there which perhaps we didn't talk about, which is what happens around high-performing teams is often you have an empathetic leader in the middle of it, and that empathetic leader is perhaps doing that processing around, you know, those micro nudging, understanding the dynamics, perhaps getting a feel for the group emotions around particular topics. Do you think that, you know, technology and AIs are actually improving to a point where they can contribute to that dynamic?
I think so. I mean, for the majority, I'd say. I mean, it's just, you know, there are some people which is naturally good at it. And, you know, I think, you know, it's certainly in the world of projects, my argument is that AI will take over all the boring, tedious stuff that we don't enjoy doing and allow people to focus on people. That's one aspect. But I think the other one is for the lesser mortals who are not naturally gifted in that area of empathy necessarily, to be given some guidance, advice and suggestions based on how the team is feeling in the moment, you know. And we're not talking about, you know, an end of activity retrospective. We're talking, you know, almost on a daily basis. But these are tiny little pulse checks of how people are feeling. It's got to be really useful. I mean, the way I particularly look at it, and we can all talk about, you know, everybody knows the classic Bruce Tuckman model of the, you know, forming, storming, norming, performing cycle, where you put the team together, you know, that's the formation, and then there's the kind of everybody finding their place in that team. That's the storming period. It's stressy, it's a bit challenged, but eventually it settles down into the norming phase. And eventually that team, when it finds, you know, all the things you talked about, when it finds that great way of working together, they enter into that kind of performing or high performing state. But In the modern world, we see so much movement of people, and particularly in temporary teams, project teams, or whatever. Resources come and go as needed. They can't sit around waiting for their turn, and they don't sit on the bench. They're doing other things. So you can imagine, my argument in the book is around that there is another phase that overlays all those other phases, which is a disrupting phase, because that's the way certainly projects are. You don't get all your resources on day one. People turn up, they leave, other people join, extra resources are applied, and it creates a disruption of the team dynamic.
Yeah, very interesting. And just thinking about that team dynamic and the way you talked about previously how you love it when a team sustains its own momentum. I think what happens there, I mean, we talked about the power of empathy within a team, but of course, that's just one of the skill sets that high performing teams, there will be an empath somewhere there that actually is, it contributes to the team in that particular way. But there are other characteristics, and a lot of these characteristics are sort of pulled out, aren't they, through various personality profiles and leadership development assessments. So, you have the empath, and I'll use the wrong terms. I'm probably mixing up some models here. You have the director, you've got the analyst, you've got the seer, you've got the naysayer, you've got the cheerleader. And it's so interesting, isn't it? I think, when you've got a diverse range of personality types or personality preferences, however you want to describe it, you see the baton being passed when teams work well. They understand, they have an intuitive understanding that, okay, we're getting down to some nitty gritty here. We need Joe to bring his analytical skills to bear on this particular problem. And okay, we've now got an answer, but Jim and Sue are arguing about this. And so we need Jacqueline to bring her empathetic skills to express both sides of the problem in a simplistic way that the group can move forward with. And okay, we're losing momentum here, so we need Ahmed to, just remind us about North Star and encourage us forward. And you see that with teams. So you see people play roles in teams. Either they generate themselves into those roles or they naturally play those roles. And I think you can be you can engineer this a bit. You asked the question at the beginning about how this is done. And I think there is an element of engineering teams when you have that luxury of bringing in new teams together, of wanting to have those different personality types and looking for them during the interview process. Look at sports team. You see successful managers who have had two or three generations of successful football teams, and there tends to be that blend of you have the water carriers, you have the blinding talent, you have the members that do the hard yards. You have the cheerleaders. It's very interesting. I don't like sports metaphors normally, but I think in this case, it's a good illustration of how you need different sorts of personality types on teams to make them work properly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we could reference what's happening to one of our major teams right now. It has some of the highest paid footballers on the planet playing for it, and they can't win a match, full stop. I mean, it's just there is no team there. It is individuals on a pitch who are not playing a game as it should be, which is incredible considering their past history. So yeah, I think it's a strong need to have the team to bond in the right way, and I guess that's kind of the skill of a manager to make that happen. But I was reflecting what my original question is, because what I've never really asked you is, I mean, how much choice you had in some of your teams, or how many did you just get given the orphans and the confused and said, well, somehow this guy can actually make this group into a team?
Well, given that some of the orphans and confused might be listening to this,
No, this is true. Yeah.
no,
No names.
I wouldn't describe it like this. So, yeah, I mean, I've sort of done the role I have 5 times now, is it? And on each occasion, there's been an element of inheriting a team and an element of building a team. I think unless you're in a startup mode, there's always an incumbent population that are doing normally great work, and this brings us on to the sort of the requirement to always be extremely respectful of the fact that you've got groups of people that do great work, and then because the landscape changes, or because the technology changes, or because the go-to-market model changes, what they do is perhaps not as relevant anymore to the future direction of the enterprise. And it's very disenfranchising for people to go through that sort of exercise where they're working hard and from being appreciated, they're suddenly not appreciated. And so there's something about bringing people on the journey, you know, people who want to, you know, be on the journey. I talk about getting on the bus. I don't think that's my phrase, but it's about ensuring that as you move into new teams or you inherit new teams or you're tasked with managing a team that hasn't worked together before, that you go through an exercise of getting everyone on the bus, making sure that everyone's engaged with the collective endeavor. And then what will naturally happen is, you know, there'll probably be natural turnover because not everyone will want to play that particular game. And so you then have the opportunity to supplement the team with a talent that perhaps isn't existing in the team for whatever reason. And so I think that's where the blending comes in. That's where perhaps the black art comes in. But that whole process of leading a team through a transformation, I mean, we haven't talked about leadership through transformation very much, but it is quite interesting because it brings out all those elements of leadership. I mean, you know, everyone has a different definition of what leadership is. But in this context, you know, we've talked about vision, haven't we? We've talked about, you know, communication. We've talked about ensuring that people are bought into what the future state looks like. And there's a leadership responsibility associated with that. We talked about culture, which is sort of a custodianship, isn't it? It's about ensuring that, you know, you as a group adhere to that culture. And that's not a soft thing. I mean, it can be demonstrating values, but it can be a hard thing sometimes. I mean, you know, you and I have had situations where we've had disruptive behavior, even, you know, behavior of a caustic nature, bad behavior. And it's easy within a high performing team to let that go because someone's so talented. And, you know, we've seen it in our past with high performing salespeople, haven't we, where they've produced extraordinary numbers. And so an organization is very reluctant to do anything about their bad behavior. But actually their bad behavior is corrosive. It's cancerous, actually. It eats away at everybody because it erodes the values of the organization. And if it's not acted upon, it devalues the whole statements of intention. And so, you know, there's a custodian nature of values which actually can sometimes needs to be very hard edged, in that there is a line over which people can't go if you're going to be credible and consistent with your vision. And then of course there's communication. You know, there's that whole business, and you know, being either evangelical or quietly servant leading and allowing a group to, you know, evolve a communication style but actually gets a message out that's congruent with the future state. So there's a lot of leadership elements in this as well, aren't there, Peter?
Well, you know, it is your squid of the day next month. So, you know, you can pursue that further if you so wish.
Well, I think I've done it though, haven't I?
Okay. There goes a whole episode down the back. But okay, I'm gonna draw on something. I mean, your points are well made about, but the other thing of high performing teams is it doesn't mean they're all nice to each other. They're respectful of each other, but it doesn't mean there aren't disagreements. Doesn't mean there isn't tension. And I suppose that's a bit like, you know, when bands are at their peak making music, there's often quite a high level of tension between them. And then suddenly it breaks. That's when they go their musical differences, different directions, individual solo albums, etc., and then reform 30 years later because they're broke. But teams, high-performing teams, do need to be able to challenge each other. It's kind of a trust thing, I guess.
Absolutely. And I would argue that without that challenging component, you know, that team will just wither because, you know, it won't address the big issues. And if you've got a diverse team, it's not possible to be authentic, address the questions on the table, and you know, in your words, be nice to each other all the time. but I love the fact that, you know, if I think about every team that I've had the privilege to be part of, it has had a completely different flavor. You know, some were super bright, and there was such a buzz by being surrounded by extraordinarily talented people. Some were just wacky.
I wasn't in that one, was I?
No, that was before I met you, Peter. Some were, here we go, we're getting into Peter territory now. Some were really wacky.
There I am.
Yeah. Some were really funny. And teams establish an identity, don't they? I mean, you sort of see it superficially with T-shirts and team names and, you know, team games. Do you remember the game that we had a few incarnations previously, where every quarter the management team would come together and we'd have a quarterly business review.
Yeah.
And we'd go out for dinner and we would challenge each other with a task. And it would be a silly task or a difficult task. And we never did it, but we spent the whole evening planning how we would do it. And the next QBR, we never referred back to it. Do you remember that wonderful occasion when we had a new senior vice president coming across, joined our team meeting, not only sort of got into this, bonding with the team, which was really good of him,
yeah,
but he then went off and delivered against his challenge. Do you remember that?
He broke the rules.
He broke the rules. It was so funny. And then on the next QBR, when, you know, he was saying, so, Daz, did you learn how to play that particular piece on the piano? Peter, did you manage to date two women in the same actually, that's a story for another time. And then, well, and then he very proudly declared the fact that he had become a hockey coach and he had managed to get his Cubs team up to the top of the league. And we were obviously very impressed, but we were very amused by the fact that that wasn't the game.
Overachiever, absolute overachiever. You know, outrageous, really. Yes, because it was great fun because it was coming up with the ideas and arguing about the minutiae of the rules around the idea of what qualified as success or not, and then forgetting about it completely.
Yeah, and yeah. So some teams, well, all teams develop an identity, and that's part of the fun of it. And I think that's you know, you need to spend time on that. You need to spend time on what makes the team buzz. You know, is it food? Is it, you know, is it laughter? Is it intellectual challenges? Is it competition? You know, is it support? There's always a theme. There's a golden thread running through a team dynamic, which when you find it, it's magical, and you can hold on to it for perhaps a year or two, and then, you know, natural, you know, changes. People evolve, and it's very hard to keep you going for longer than that, in my opinion.
Indeed,
but
indeed.
You need to find that thread, I think.
Well, you know, I bribed my team by a mixologist to invent a cocktail, the GPMO. It's the ingredients begin with each of those letters, GPMO. So there is a GPMO cocktail, should you ever wish to try it one day.
Well, I would, Peter. So there we go. I think you're making my point. It's about team dynamics being very, very individual, and some of them are wacky.
Yeah, all right, good. And I think that's a great place to begin to wind things up. Well, the other quote, which I'm just looking at all my notes, the one I didn't mention was the African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, take a team.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's,
a good way to end, Peter. It's a good topic. Thank you for that.
It's my pleasure. So, we will definitely be back. And Daz will be bronze from his trip to the island we can't name anymore. And, we look forward to sharing a little bit more with you. So thanks for being with us. And goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me. Thanks all. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an unusual podcast from David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor. More information can be found at www.squidofdespair.com. Thank you.